The first successful birth of a test tube baby, Louise Brown, occurred in 1978. And in the more than 30 years since this first birth, there have been many advances in assisted reproduction. In 2009 alone, it was reported that these procedures resulted in more than 60,000 infants born in the United States. Well, joining us this morning to tell us more about the current state of help for infertility and the full range of reproductive endocrinology services right here in Central New York is Dr. Frederick Sendstack, Assistant Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology in the Division of Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility, and also the director of the In Vitro Fertilization Program at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Sendstack. Thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start out. This term, reproductive endocrinology, tell us, what is that? What does it mean?
Okay, well, endocrinology is the field of medicine that addresses diseases of the endocrine system, which are hormone-producing glands. That includes the thyroid gland, the adrenal gland, the pituitary, the pancreas. All glands that are hormone-producing come under the realm of endocrinology. Now, in medicine, there are several fields, subspecialties of endocrinology. You have pediatric endocrinology, surgical endocrinology, doctors who operate on endocrine glands. You have medical endocrinology, which is a subspecialty of internal medicine. And then there's reproductive endocrinology, which is a subspecialty of obstetrics and gynecology. So each field kind of has a little different twist. We concentrate on diseases specifically related to the female reproductive tract as they are affected by or as the reproductive tract affects the endocrine system. So it's the field of endocrinology specifically related to reproductive function.
Okay.
Now, there's a lot of crossover as well because we work together with our colleagues. I might see a young patient, for instance, in the pediatric age group, and if it's a female patient, then very often we would be involved if it's an endocrine problem. However, there are areas where we work together or we cross-refer some of these problems.
So what are the kinds of problems, just to help us understand? I mean, you did a wonderful job of an overview of understanding kind of
yes.
how the fields are divided. But who would you see? What are the kinds of situations or problems you would see?
Well, reproductive endocrinology actually also includes infertility. It's actually called REI, or reproductive endocrinology and infertility, but it doesn't only address infertility problems, although that is also part of what we see. So all areas of infertility and fertility-related issues come under the realm of reproductive endocrinology. We also see patients who have disease processes such as endometriosis, women who have any medical problem that affects the reproductive tract that may also impact on the endocrine system. Examples would be something called polycystic ovarian syndrome, women with menstrual irregularities, patients who are not ovulating, not releasing eggs. That's called anovulation. Women with abnormal hair growth on their face or their body, that's referred to as hirsutism. It's usually associated with an increase in the male hormone production. We see patients with elevated levels of a hormone called prolactin, which comes from a little gland in the brain called the pituitary gland. And elevated prolactin can make women miss their periods. It can cause them to have a nipple discharge. So there's many areas that cross over into reproductive endocrinology and infertility.
And you mentioned pediatrics earlier
yes.
when you mentioned a type of patient. So would you begin to see children, for example, who had showed some indication that they might have some underlying endocrine problem, which would then lead them later on to have reproductive issues?
Oh, yes, definitely. For instance, we see patients with abnormalities of puberty. And again, there's crossover with the pediatric endocrinologists. Very often, the first person to see the children would be the pediatrician, the general pediatrician. And then if it's an endocrine problem, they may refer to a pediatric endocrinologist. But some of those problems affect or are impacted on by the reproductive tract. So therefore, we do have some crossover.
How about things like fibroid tumors,
yes.
those kinds of things? So you really see a wide range of gynecological problems.
Oh, yeah.
Then.
Again, there's crossover even within our own field of of specialty. For instance, fibroid tumors, which for the most part can be managed in many cases by the general OBGYN physician, but there are cases that are more difficult to manage, or there may be cases where the fibroids or what we call myomas are located in areas that can be a little tricky to remove, and our role is to try to preserve the reproductive tract. So very often if a patient has completed her childbearing and she's having symptoms from fibroid tumors, then she may see her general gynecologist and they may recommend a hysterectomy. And then in that case, the problem is solved. On the other hand, we may see patients who have not completed their childbearing and they want to preserve their uterus, and we can offer them various procedures, techniques, even medications that can treat the fibroids without removing the uterus.
We've been doing a lot of interviews of late about the more minimally invasive kinds of procedures that are happening. Are you using some of those as well in your approaches?
Yeah, we do minimally invasive surgery as well. You know, a lot of times these procedures require a judgment call. Mm-hmm. But we do those procedures as well.
Well, I'm going to ask you to hold on to that idea just for a minute because we are going to have to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll have more with Dr. Sendzdak, and we'll be talking about reproductive endocrinology and all of the new approaches, actually, that are taking place with assisted reproduction. We'll be right back. Dr. Frederick Sendzdak, and we're talking about reproductive endocrinology, assisted reproduction, and in vitro fertilization. And before the break, you were very helpful in explaining kind of how reproductive endocrinology plays a role in all these issues. Tell me, what is exactly happening these days? I know so many breakthroughs have taken place in what we call ART, or assisted reproductive technology. What's happening now these days?
Okay, well, it's a constantly evolving field. I remember when I was doing my fellowship at Georgetown University back in 1981, the first conference that was at an academic institution for in vitro fertilization was actually held at the Eastern Shore Virginia Medical School. And the first IVF conference in the United States was actually given by Dr. Howard Jones, who was the first to achieve an in vitro fertilization pregnancy in the United States. This is following the British breakthrough. He brought the technology back to the United States and was subsequently able to have a IVF pregnancy. And then he had a big conference for doctors interested in that technology. And I was fortunate enough to have attended that first conference. And it was very interesting because over the years, looking at the things that have changed has been pretty fascinating. But looking at the things that haven't changed very much has also been pretty fascinating.
So what's changed first?
Well, one thing that has changed is that a lot of people don't realize that the first IVF pregnancy was in a natural cycle. They didn't use any stimulatory drugs, and the egg was also captured using laparoscopy, which is one of the minimally invasive surgical techniques that we use today. However, it does require a general anesthetic. We now retrieve eggs under ultrasound using conscious sedation, if you will, so that the patient doesn't have to be put under a general anesthetic, and we're not using as invasive a technique. So that's one of the major changes. Also, in the 1990s, a doctor by the name of Palermo, I believe is his last name, Palermo, he was the first to use a technique in humans called ICSI, which is intracytoplasmic sperm injection. And that was a technique that has now allowed us to overcome male infertility in a significant way, because the embryologist can take one spermatozoa, one sperm cell, and inject it directly into the egg, and you get over 80% chance of that egg being fertilized. so that even if there's a male factor now, we can significantly overcome that problem just by doing the ICSI procedure.
So if, for example, the person, the male partner, wasn't mm-hmm. producing sufficient numbers of sperm, where in a natural setting wouldn't quite make it
exactly.
to the egg, you literally take what looks like a healthy sperm.
Right.
And you can inject it into the egg and get success that way.
That's correct.
That's so incredible.
That was a very big advance in vitro fertilization. Also, egg freezing, embryo freezing, a lot of these technologies are still evolving. Egg freezing, although it's been around for some time, it has resulted in pregnancies, but it's not a technology that has become as far advanced as, let's say, freezing sperm. We have sperm banks that have been around for many, many years. The egg is a very unique cell. It's the largest cell in the human body. It contains a large amount of water. And when you freeze a cell that contains a large amount of water, it causes the water to crystallize. And that can damage the genetic portion of the cell, what's called the spindle. And it can interfere with normal cell division, and the cell can die if you crystallize it. So that techniques have now evolved for freezing eggs, and that has given us another opportunity that can be used for many, many different procedures.
Yes, it struck me actually that was more of a recent breakthrough, that before that it was my understanding that embryos, meaning once the egg and the sperm had actually come together and had a union, that embryo could be frozen, and that's routinely done, I think.
With
in vitro fertilization, they may stimulate they may produce a number of embryos and then only implant one or two at most and take those others and freeze them. So they have that success they know that that's a successful technique to later thaw, I guess, use those embryos. But the egg, for all the reasons you just described, was something that was elusive in terms of being able to successfully freeze a woman's eggs.
That's correct.
And now yet you're saying that it is being done.
Oh, yeah. Pregnancies have resulted from, we like to call them oocytes, which is the medical term for eggs. But oocyte cryopreservation or freezing is a technology that is now accepted as a fairly standard technology, but it's not as routine as embryo freezing. It requires much more technical savvy, if you will, and there are different techniques that can use with varying degrees of success.
So from your experience, help us understand what circumstances you might find the need to freeze an egg, let's say, in a given patient, as opposed to?
Well, one of the main areas that is being addressed now is actually a new field that's referred to as oncofertility. And it's kind of a crossover between oncology, gynecologic oncology, general oncology, and reproductive endocrinology. That term actually, I think, initiated at Northwestern University in Chicago. They now have what's called an oncofertility consortium, which involves several academic institutions around the country.
Wow.
I'm hoping that Upstate can eventually become part of that consortium. But the idea is to be able to preserve fertility in patients who might otherwise not have that option. For example, a young woman who's still in her reproductive age group who has breast cancer, she may not only require surgical therapy, but chemotherapy, radiation therapy. Chemo and radiation therapy can be destructive to the gametes, to the sperm, and to the eggs. So as a result, once you have treated that patient, you have either completely devoided her of her egg supply, or you have significantly reduced the egg supply. And what egg freezing allows you to do is to stimulate the ovary in advance of her therapy, extract the eggs and freeze them. And then after she has completed her therapy, she now has frozen eggs that can be used for in vitro fertilization in the future.
Well, that's an amazing breakthrough.
It really is.
I mean, to really be able to do that is amazing, because we're hearing more and more young people being afflicted with cancer and women with breast cancer at younger ages. So that really lends a lot of hope to their ability to then have their own children someday.
It's a very very fascinating area and very rewarding, because what has happened, I think, and oncologists are becoming more aware of this, but what has happened over the years is people were addressing the oncology issues, but they just kind of let the fertility issues go by the wayside. And then these patients, after their therapy, are told, well, now you're sterile and you have no options except maybe to consider donor in vitro, where another woman can contribute an egg, but they would not be able to have their own biologic children.
From your experience, and it sounds like you have a lot, have you seen any problems arise, or any developmental issues, or any issues that come of any of these techniques in terms of the normal growth and development of the fetuses and the children?
Right. Well, that's always been a question, even from the beginning. Many people thought that if you're manipulating human gametes in the laboratory, you're going to create some sort of monster. That really has not borne out in reality. However, there have been some recent studies that have shown that ICSI, intracytoplasmic sperm injection, has been, in some studies, associated with a slightly increased risk of certain types of congenital abnormalities. Now, the data is still being analyzed, and a lot of people don't really know exactly how to interpret some of the data. And I think that we're being cautious about it in terms of advising patients. But anytime you change the natural selection process, there is a potential risk. An example, obviously these patients have infertility problems. So if you're doing ICSI because of a male factor, then if the embryo results from fertilization of that egg with a Y-bearing sperm, one that's going to produce a male offspring, then whatever problem that father had may be transmitted to the son. And that's also been shown to be true, that there's a slightly increased risk of certain types of reproductive abnormalities similar to what is seen in the father who contributed the sperm. So
that's,
we know that that's a potential risk. Now, when you look at the overall risk, I mean, there's a 2 to 3% chance that any baby born can have a minor congenital anomaly. So the question is, if the babies that we're seeing are within that 2 to 3%, was it really the in vitro procedure,
or
was that
know.
Something that would have occurred naturally? So that's the argument that people are making.
Right. But overall, all in all, it seems like it's made a huge difference in a lot of people's lives to the better.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, people who might not have ever thought they could have a child naturally of their own are now having children.
That's correct.
It also seems like there's been a lot more, a lot of women these days choosing career first.
Yes.
And waiting longer seem to need some assistance along the way. So it's been an incredible breakthrough. Well, it sounds to me like you're doing amazing things for our community, being here and running this program and leaving all these options available right here in Central New York. So I want to thank you for everything you're doing. And thank you so much for coming in and sharing all that information for us. It sounds to me like seems like a really exciting direction for us, not only here at Upstate, but throughout the country. Well, thanks so much. My guest has been Dr. Frederick Sendstack, Assistant Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology at Upstate Medical University. We'll be right back right after the news with more HealthLink on air, so stay with us. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to FM News Radio 106.9 and 570 WSYR.